Good afternoon. Welcome to the Bus and Rail Subcommittee meeting today on Tuesday, October 13th, 2020. To begin with, please know that this meeting is being recorded as usual. We will be placing the meeting audio on our website, which is WMATA.com, as we do for all the meetings, whether it's AAC, BRS, or MAS meetings. Just a few helpful tips for people joining via phone call. You can press *6 to mute or unmute yourselves. If you would like to make comments, you can virtually raise or lower hands by pressing *9. Everyone joining via video conference, you can click on the mute or unmute button with that it shows like a speaker and then it says mute underneath. You can also raise hands, the virtual hands, and lower hands by clicking on the hand icon. That will indicate your intention to speak and make a comment. Please keep yourselves on mute unless speaking. This helps eliminate external noise. We do have interpreters with us on this call. It helps them do their job well. It helps anyone listening on the phone call as well as for our meeting audio recorded that's placed on the website. At this point, I will take a roll call of the committee members. So please confirm your presence. Elver Ariza Silva. Darnese Bush. Tino Calabia.
Here.
Thank you. Vanessa Coles.
Present.
Thank you. Rico Dancy.
Present.
Thank you. Melanie Jackson. Mary Kay McMahon. Philippa Mazel.
Here.
Thank you. Anthony is not going to be joining the meeting today. Phil Posner. We know that he's
present.
Connected. Thank you. Doris Ray. Denise Rush. Mary Kay is just joining. Paul Semelford. Patrick Sheehan.
Denise Rush, present.
Thank you, Ms. Rush. Kelly Simona. Okay, that concludes the roll call for today.
Steve Caffin, present.
Thank you, Steve, I have you.
Oh, okay.
And Mary Kay McMahon, I just joined.
Yes, Mary Kay, I saw you joining, so I did mark you present, thank you. I will read the agenda out loud for today's meeting. And the agenda is as follows. We just completed the roll call that gives introduction of the committee members. We will go through review and approval of the agenda and prior meeting minutes. Chair Calabia will make the motions for that. We do have our guest speaker, Mr. Brand Loney. He will give a presentation about rail car sanitizing and cleaning. So welcome, Mr. Loney. Our own director, Ms. Carol Lopez, she's the director of ADAP. She will give a presentation about hand sanitizing dispensers at stations, followed by another presentation on parking garage construction. Afterwards, the committee will have a discussion about the fiscal year 21 budget that for which we just, the budget hearing is going parallel, followed by another committee discussion about front door boarding. Ombudsman report will take place afterwards. Any public comments we have, we will take in those during the public comment period. The committee can discuss about new old business and work plan updates, and the meeting will adjourn at 6 p.m. That is the agenda for today's
meeting. Do I hear a motion to accept the agenda?
I make that motion.
My name is Christian Colbert. I'm a resident.
Second.
We're still hearing the budget hearing. Good, it's off. Is there a second to approve the agenda?
Second.
Tino.
All in favor?
Aye.
The agenda is approved. First item on the agenda now is to hear from Brand Loney on the rail car sanitizing and cleaning activities. Brand Loney.
Good afternoon, everyone. So my name is Brand Loney. I am Assistant General Superintendent in the Department of Car Maintenance, and we are tasked with the cleaning and sanitization of rail cars for passenger service. So since the COVID kickoff in the beginning of the year, we've significantly increased how we sanitize our cars. What we are currently doing, and we have been doing this since mid-March, is we have contract cleaners, which are positioned at the end of line stations. And those contract cleaners go in and they pick up trash and debris, and they also do spot disinfection as time allows. They don't have a significant amount of time because it's being done while the car is there before it goes back out on the line. And then every night we disinfect every rail car for passenger service with electrostatic sprayers. So that is the process that we're using to disinfect our cars prior to service. Is there any questions?
Yes, thank you for that. Do any members of the committee have a question?
I have a question.
Sure, Steve, go ahead.
Thank you. You know, I'm just curious, as it relates to buses, are you involved with aspects of sanitizing and cleaning? And if so, what's the process for doing that?
For buses, I'm not involved. I don't believe that it is significantly different. I think that they are currently using a process very similar to ours, but I can't speak with any great knowledge, really.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
This is Vanessa. I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
You mentioned that you spray with some kind of electric something. Does that leave a residue, you know, when people sit in the seats, or do they wipe it down after they use that aerosol, that static thing that you talked about?
So we use an electrostatic sprayer. The chemical that we use, it requires a flash time of 10 minutes. So it needs to be wet on the surface for 10 minutes to kill corona. We did significant testing with the electrostatic sprayers, and we found it was the best piece of equipment. When you put out a fogger, the mist on a fogger, a lot of times the particle sizes are a little bit larger, and it will stay wet for a lot longer, right? The electrostatic sprayer, we have a specific head size that we use on them, and it puts out a very small particle, and it only stays wet for about 15 to 20 minutes. So no, we did some testing to try to make sure that this would not occur, and we do periodic checks now to make sure that the cars are not going into service wet, but we leave it on for it to dry. It does not leave a residue.
Okay, I was just curious. Thank you.
May I have one more, make one more
question? Yes, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, thank you. You know, several transit systems have instituted the rail car sanitizing. Of course, the most famous initial one was in New York City, where we heard they were actually closing down their 24-hour service in order to do it in the early morning. I'm wondering how our process compares with what they are doing. And I also remember that they were using or introducing some kind of ultra frequency control.
Ultraviolet.
That's it. Okay, thank you.
So early on in this process, actually, there was some dialogue back and forth with some of the transit authorities. I did have dialogue with New York. What I see them using is similar to what we went to very early on in mid-March, since mid-March. Actually, in February, we saw this activity going on in China. Prior to this time, we were doing disinfection twice a month. We were doing cleaning more regularly, but actual disinfection we were doing twice a month. We saw this activity picking up in China, and we'd been wanting to improve our disinfection process anyway. So at that time, we started investigating, and we purchased a number of electrostatic sprayers. It was perfect timing. Seems like we got the last batch before the rush came in the United States. We had a lot of dialogue with New York and San Francisco and Charlotte about the various transit authorities' disinfection process. So New York is a 24-hour system, right? They operate a little bit differently. They had to kind of change their practices in order to begin instituting this process where they disinfect their cars, every one of their cars every day. For us, we don't have a 24-hour system. So when the cars come into the yard every night, since March, we have been disinfecting every car as it comes in from service prior to going into service the next day.
Mr. Loney, this is Anu. I would ask a question that the vice chair of this committee would like to know. This question is from Anthony Oberg. He would like to know how sanitization is being demonstrated to riders. One of the ways people have said they can't feel more confident is by seeing the cleaning firsthand. Because this is not always possible, how is the team working to instill that confidence?
I'm not sure that we've reached out. There has been some communication activity through media relations, and I think about how we're doing so that it could be communicated out. But that's probably something we could go back and look at to make sure that we assure the riders, you know, the levels of cleaning that we're going to try to ensure their safety.
Okay.
I have a comment.
Yes, sir.
I looked at webpage on WMATA's website. And for example, it mentions that WMATA has bought so many bottles of disinfectant that if you put them together, they would reach up into the air 17 and a half miles, which is almost three times as far as commercial airplanes go. That's an interesting factoid, but I don't know if it helps. And this is the reason, especially now, you know, 7 months of the pandemic have gone by. And during that time, the health scientists like physicians and epidemiologists have learned that contact infection is not as dangerous as was originally thought. In fact, I think Teresa Impastato said that, for example, wearing gloves is not to be too encouraged. In fact, it picks up germs, and taking it off would transmit possible germs. So in effect, while it's great that you're carrying out your duties regarding cleansing and disinfecting the trains, to me, that's not as important as the question of the kind of filtration that are on buses, and I know you don't deal with buses, but on buses and subways, as I understand it, probably the best kind of filtration system is germicidal. It uses ultraviolet rays, in fact, maybe ultraviolet C, both on buses, in their filtration system, as well as in their subway system. In fact, before the pandemic, the Dallas bus transit system involves 700 buses, and almost 700 of those have already been equipped with germicidal ventilation systems, and they did that even before the pandemic occurred. There are other places that are using it. I think New York's MTA is beginning to test it, and in fact, I understand that there's a nearby manufacturer who has developed a germicidal filtration system. And while there may be some hesitation on the part of transit systems, they are willing to install one free in a bus to have the that system look at it, demonstrate it, and decide whether it works for them. I've also learned that these germicidal filtration systems can pay off themselves in maybe a year and a half or two. And so afterwards, it's almost a profit. Could you talk about the germicide or the kind of filtration system that is on the subways, which you handle, about the filtration system in buses?
Yeah, I'm working to pull up some information. We had recently sent some information regarding the specifics of the exchange rate and the filtration types on our car. As I look for that, let me talk about some of the other things. So I know Mr. Kaifin had also asked about the ultraviolet light. We recently put out a request, I think it was a request for information, a request for proposal, seeking input into what is available in the industry. There are several manufacturers that have come to us recently with solutions. Integrating them into a rail car is not always as easy as just plugging it in and putting it in place. We have been working with the manufacturers to look and see what is available and incorporate something, not just to put something in place, but make sure that we're putting something in place that is effective. So we, on the engineering side, there's a lot of activity at the COO level as well, pushing to look for long-term solutions. There's also some pretreatment chemicals that you can apply to surfaces. You apply it to the surface, and it kills the chemical, or it kills the germ on contact. So these are some of the things that we have been looking at. We haven't implemented some. We've started to look at testing some and measuring effectiveness. I can't speak in detail because we're still discussing, but these are things that we are proactively looking at now.
Well, Brand, this is really important because, you know, I and a lot of other elderly people and other riders are fearful of going into subways or especially buses, the enclosed buses, without the best filtration system. And I'm glad that WMATA is looking at the germicidal filtration systems because that offers at the moment apparently the best way of killing those germs. You know, you're doing a good job in terms of contact disinfection. You do it overnight, the bus goes out, But once the bus goes out, somebody who's infected can come in and contaminate it again, you know? What's would really help me and other elderly folks and those with disabilities who are fearful of being infected in our metro system, be they the subways or the buses, we would be better assured if we knew that not only is the contact process covered by you at night, but that during the day, filtration systems will kill the germs that enter into subway trains or buses when they're running. I can send you the homework I've done. I've looked at many, many articles on the subject, and I can send you at least 7 that deal with buses and subways. If you could just give me your email, what is your email?
Sure, my email is...
We can connect directly through Anu, and Anu can send the information to Mr. Looney.
Well, I'd rather just send it directly this afternoon. Brent, can you... Yes, please.
Are you okay with that, Carol? I'm okay with it.
Yes.
Okay. So my email address is B, initial for my first name, and then it's Loney, Loney.
Without a period or anything?
Correct. Yep.
Okay, Bloney.
Yes, at WMATA.com.
At WMATA.com. I will send this to you and share it with the committee about the materials I've seen regarding germicidal filtration systems, which will operate while the vehicle, be it a bus or a subway, is in transit. And it should easily complement what you, Brand, are doing at night.
So we are continuing, and we will continue. It's very open to look at what you have. We also have been looking at solutions, and we're looking to incorporate solutions.
Well, not only looking, but perhaps installing them. I mean, if they're not installed, we're just studying it. I'm not going into a bus or a train which doesn't have the best kind of filtration system available today. And if we're going to convince other people to boost ridership by taking the subway and trains, we can then advertise that these kind of best filtration systems are available. At that point, once they become available, wearing a mask, I will go back into a bus and a subway, which I haven't done since mid-March, and I'm sure there are a few others who haven't done so either. Are there any other questions for Mr. Loney?
Yes, Chair Calabi, I see Barbara's hand is up. Barbara, go ahead and ask your question.
Barbara?
Thank you, Brand, for your good work. You guys are the unsung heroes of all this. You're on the front lines, and I just want to say that I appreciate your efforts. And I am asking a question here about when is the optimal time, in your opinion, to ride a bus or a rail during this? My assumption would be kind of right out of, you know, the first train out, after, because they've been cleaned overnight. But if we can't make it that time, like when would you personally, if you had to take a bus or the rail, when would it be safest?
That's a subjective question. I'm not sure that I would feel comfortable riding the trains with the exchange rate that we have in the air, with the disinfection process that we're using. I would feel comfortable putting my family on the trains with what I know at any time, just so long as they wear a mask, they wash their hands when done, and you know, they be wary of social distancing. Yes, there's always ways to improve it's and going back to the UV light, we want to put a solution on the train that we know that we can maintain, that not just we can put a UV light up into the air system, but that we can also be assured is going to do the job that it's designed to do, and also that we can maintain, because we don't want to have a false sense of security that we're putting the UV light up there and it's not going to operate. These are sealed systems. There's a lot that goes into putting it where it needs to be most effective to kill that germ. So there's a lot that goes into the background that you know, maybe is not seen by a passenger, but we certainly don't want to be putting something out there with a false sense of hope that it's going to be doing the job when at the end of the day, the light bulb could be broken or it could be burnt out. And we don't have the ability to see that because it's not in a place where it allows for normal monitoring.
Okay. I was wondering if you could say if riding the bus or the rail is safer.
I can't speak on bus. I'm not sure what their processes are. I'm comfortable with our process. From what I've seen from buses' process, I believe their process is very similar to ours. So I would be comfortable with the processes if in bus, if they're doing what we're doing.
And then it would just be a matter of your luck sitting next to a person or standing next to a person who happens to have COVID. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you so much for coming today.
Yes, Brand, one other question.
Yes.
As I understand it, the filtration systems, the initials are MERV, MERV.
MERV rating.
The ratings go from 1 to 20.
Right.
Can you tell me what filtration number is, the number of the MERV is on the subway trains that you're assigned to?
Yeah, hold on one sec. I was looking for this and I got distracted. Give me a moment, sir, and I'll come back. I had the information.
Okay, while you're looking, let me mention that there is a web page that the public can see regarding COVID-19. It doesn't deal with filtration systems at all. Like I say, it mentions those bottles which can extend 17 and a half miles up into the air, which you use overnight to disinfect the trains that you're assigned to. You know, if we're going to convince the public that buses and trains are safer, there are other metro systems and bus systems that have published more than a web page about what they've done. But the web page we have now, and I think the latest one is dated August 26th, and it just deals with the 17 and a half miles of disinfectant that you use. That's not as helpful as if we had something regarding the filtration system, which you're trying to look up now.
Maybe Carol can work too.
Carol, can you help us with this?
You want us to add more information on the website? Yes, I can ask.
Yes.
Okay, so back to the question about the filters. So the filters that we use at WMATA on a rail car are a MERV 8 filter.
MERV 8?
Yes.
Holy cow. I think the better ones start at MERV 13 or 14. And like I said, the MERV numbers go up to 20. I'm not quite sure what number Dallas uses, but they have these germicidal filtration systems on the bus. There are almost 700 buses, and they've been doing this since pre-pandemic.
Tino, this is, Brad is only talking about the trains today, and he's talking about trains that open doors every a few minutes, or three doors on one side. It's not the same as the bus.
No, I understand that.
So the filtration systems would probably be slightly different, and the MERV ratings that you're indicating might be something that may perhaps they have to go on airplanes and things that are like that, that, you know, are concealed for a longer period of time. I'm not an expert on this, but I'm just giving you some guys, some back.
No, I understand. Yes. I understand. But Brand, again, what MERV number did you say are used on the subways?
We use a MERV 8. 65% of the air is recycled.
That's all?
Yes. We have a full replacement of air every 3 minutes and 6 seconds. And we recycled air is replaced on average at least 19 times an hour.
Okay, but if somebody sneezes in between those 19 minutes, you know, that's dangerous for the rest of the people in that enclosed car.
A full air replacement for every 3 minutes, Brent?
Yes, 19 times.
So that means that it's more than a hospital. For example, hospitals are required to have an air change of one air change per hour. And ICU rooms are required to have 4 air changers per hour.
Well, the hospitals
and Kolmada trains have 1 air change every 3 minutes and 8 seconds.
With respect to hospitals, I imagine that they have a better filtration system, and maybe even in the ICUs, the germicidal filtration system, which actually kills the virus in that room. In any event, is there anyone else who has a question for Mr. Loney?
Doris, Chair Calabria, Doris has her hand up. Doris, go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, this is Doris Ray from Virginia. I was just wondering a couple of things about the bus, because I ride bus and rail under normal circumstances just about every day, and sometimes multiple times a day for both work and home errands. So the thing that I'm really I am very concerned about disinfecting surfaces, so I am very glad that's getting done, and in your case with the rail, certainly. But my understanding of the biggest infection risk actually is that spray from an infected person, whether it's through mouth or whether it's through nose, can hang in the air and for a certain period of time. And they've recently noted that it may hang in the air for longer than we think. But this, I think, in particular, tells us that number one concern should be the social distancing. So I'm wondering, because I haven't been on a rail train in some time for reasons that most of us haven't, and because I take the bus to get there, but I'm wondering, are you sectioning off seats in the rail system, and whether you know if they're doing the same on the bus, so that there is some adequate spacing between you. And I'm wondering whether for both the rail cars, when they come to the end of the line and the drivers have some break, or at the end of a bus line or something, do the bus drivers or the rail operators or station staff, in the case of rail, have some role in being able to disinfect the surfaces more than once? Because handling the poles and anything else in the station, but all of that, that's another big problem with with getting infected. And when you get off those trains, unless it's Silver Line, you have no public restroom to go wash your hands, and washing your hands is a big part of the regimen. So I hope you see what I'm asking, which is the particles in the air in the train or the bus, it can help to, obviously it's been proven if you're wearing a mask that distance between you and other people is important. And the last question I have is, can a bus driver, maybe not a rail operator, but can a bus driver tell somebody who's actually actively coughing to get off the bus? So I guess that's three questions.
I do not have an answer for that, but and Brand doesn't have a bus.
I have a suggestion on it. Mm-hmm. First of all, even the Metro Rail police are not enabled to enforce mask wearing. And with respect to bus drivers, I mentioned in earlier meetings that a bus driver, and I forget in which city, but he heard a rider coughing in the back, standing in the back. And I think even took a video of it. And within a few days, he died from COVID-19. So on the one hand, there's no enforcement, certainly not local, by authorities here. And with respect to drivers, you can't expect them to try and enforce it. As a matter of fact, they've taken such a beating for trying to enforce other things as well as mask driving that I don't blame them that they let things like that pass, even though it's at the risk of their lives. It is now 4:38, and we're getting to part of what Doris asked about, because we're dealing next with Carol Lopez, who's going to talk about hand sanitizing. But Brand, thank you very much for the information you've given about Metro Rails, and I will send you some we can look at regarding germicidal disinfectants, germicidal filtration systems for both subways and metro buses. Thank you again, Brad.
You know, please copy both Anu and myself when you send that.
I will copy the whole committee.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you. And thank you so much, Brand, for joining us. Okay, so my presentation is basically an update on the hand sanitizing stations in at all metro stations. The hand sanitizing towers have a pump that can be activated with your foot. And there's also one immediate attached in the same device that can be activated by just putting your hand underneath it and the fluid comes down. The reason it had to be, Anu's sharing the device, the reason it had to be done this way is because the ones that allow you to have a pump can be filled with more hand sanitizer at the same time. Therefore, it would help us in the maintenance of keeping those filled. And then there's also the smaller device on the side, which is what you see in most malls, et cetera, is the one where you put your hand underneath and the hand sanitizer comes in. From the ADA perspective, we've looked at sanitizers that have no perfumes, and so we've made sure that that was the case. And we also made sure, and I can tell you that the group that was procuring this and from plant, a lot of effort came about getting these together to make sure that they're accessible, to make sure that they're going to have enough so that it doesn't run out in the morning rush hour. And also to make sure they're going to be in every entrance, including the mini mezzanines, where somebody comes in through the elevator directly to our stations. So that's in the effort. We have some already at Gallery Place, and today they started to deploy them at, I think they're going from the center on out. I don't know the exact plan. There's a coordination effort that the busier stations are getting them first, and they're going to be finished by the first week of November, deploying all of this and installing them. So I just wanted to let you know that those miles of hand sanitizer are also going to the customers' hands.
Doris, does that help answer your question?
Am I on?
Yes.
I hear you, yes.
Okay. The answer is no. My question was actually for the gentleman about whether there were other methods for allowing for disinfecting surfaces during the course of the day, because one disinfecting of a rail car, for example, isn't going to last the whole day, and it may not even last. You're never going to know whether the surface is dirty. So you've just got to deal with that until you get out of the system, I think. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about these hand sanitizing dispensers is where they're going to be located, how I'm, as a blind person, I'm going to find them. And then secondly, are they going to be placed at the top of escalators? Because, you know, one of the most dirty places is putting your hands on the escalators as you're exiting the station. So, you know, the most important thing here is that one could potentially, even if you got on a full mask, for some reason have to touch your eyes, and you could get infected very easily or get something on your face and whatever. So, I think having the hand sanitizer at entrances and exits, and not just in the mezzanines, you know, if you're riding the elevator, it could be there, but I'm not clear where they're going to be located, okay, particularly if you're not using the elevators.
They're going to be located near the station manager's kiosk.
Okay, but see, then I use it there, and then I get on the escalators.
Okay.
And the effect is all gone.
So there are a lot of maintenance issues related to putting hand sanitizers everywhere. We wouldn't be able to police, I shouldn't use that word, but to keep the hand sanitizers where they're supposed to be if we put them on the street, you know, when you exit. So at some point, we all have to carry our own hand sanitizing devices, wipes, etc. But WMATA is doing what they can to provide this convenience to the customers. Perhaps as you're exiting, you put some hand sanitizer on one hand and you hold on to the escalator with the other. And then when you get to the top, you rub them together and you're done. You know, I must tell you, and this is just from my personal experience, I've been riding the Metro everywhere because I have to answer a lot of questions to all, this committee, et cetera. And I've never felt unsafe about it. I guess particularly because I guess ridership is very low. I even when I'm riding during rush hour, I'm still, you know, not sitting right next to another person. I feel safe sitting in one seat and not somebody, a stranger sitting next to me. But I've also flown on airplanes where I had people next to me, and I had to quarantine myself for 2 weeks, considering we're working from home, et cetera. So I have done all those things, and I've used the correct masks. And sometimes when you're concerned, you can use those shields, so that, you know, you don't get contaminated on your eyes. But one thing I've noticed, this is a new one, so that's why it doesn't look transparent enough. But one thing I've noticed with these things is that when I'm talking to people, they can't hear me because the voice bounces back. So you become, it's a little more difficult. But there are a lot of things you can do to protect yourself, and Metro's doing the best Metro can do to protect everyone.
Carol, we do have a couple of questions. I see Dr. Posner has his hand up. Before you go on, Dr. Posner, I just want to state a couple of questions that we have received from Elver Ariza Silver. First question he had, you have actually kind of answered it already, but I will state it for the record. His question is why it took too long for WMATA to begin to distribute the portable sanitizer. I have seen only one at Gallery Place Chinatown Mezzanine exit 7th Street where there are two elevators. His second question is, I did try the sanitizer tower and it was accessible to my needs and ability, but what about for people who are blind? How do they know where they are? And that's part of Doris's question. I mean, specific signage for them, right, left. He's talking about direction.
Okay, so maybe we should provide some information particular. Once they are deployed, unfortunately, we can't do anything before they install them, because sometimes you plan something on a floor plan and something doesn't work when you get there. Please ask the station manager where the hand sanitizer is when you're not familiar with the station, if you can't see it. The hand sanitizer is a white tower that is gonna stick out. Hopefully it's gonna stay white for a long time. It's gonna stick out a little bit from the rest of the environment in Metro. So it's not blending in. It's something white and it's a little tower. It's got some dimension. So you might be able to see it if you have low vision. Now, if you're blind, please ask the station manager and they will guide you to it. Putting additional tactile signage or anything is just going to involve touching more things that you have to sanitize so it would be difficult to provide that type of information. We can try to provide more verbal information that you can access. And I will make that note to see if we can do something like that.
Carol, is it close to the station manager's kiosk, or is it close to, is there more than one, for instance, on one side of the kiosk where there are fare gates, and then on the other side of the kiosk where there are fare gates?
There's only one at each location, and it would be near the station manager's kiosk.
Okay. Dr. Posner, go ahead and ask a question, please.
Yes, assuming that your hand sanitizers are not ones that use methanol or on the do not use list put out by the CDC and the FDA.
They are not on that do not use list.
The other thing I'd like to point out to all of the paranoid people in the group, the hand sanitizers as recommended by the CDC are useful if you wash your hands first and get 90% of the bacteria off by washing. Surgeons scrub before they use sanitizer. Yeah. If you're particularly worried, and you should be, I recommend you wear gloves. And if you're worried about the escalator, carry a little container of Lysol or Clorox wipes and feel free to wipe the area that you're going to touch. The same thing when you're sitting down. So you can do your own sanitization, but don't depend on the little squeegee of hand sanitizer to do anything but make you feel good. You should also know that the infection rate and the disease rates are statistically very low. I'm not Donald Trump, but I'm just telling you, you don't need to be totally paranoid about this stuff. So that wear a mask, wear a glove for contact, wash your hands when you take the gloves off, and then use the hand sanitizer. And you're doing all of the appropriate things to be protected. And you know, if your name's on the blackboard in the sky, with all the PPP in the world is, your number is gonna come up. But you can reduce the statistics and increase your odds by being protective. And your self-protection is more important than anything else. Stay away from people that are coughing, wear your mask, and wash your hands, wear your gloves, and use your personal sanitizers. And enough of the public health speech from me. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Carol?
We do trust our doctor who's a scientist.
I didn't hear you.
I was just saying we do trust our doctor who's a scientist.
Yeah, Christian, thank you. Carol is on with the next item, the parking garage construction.
You're muted, Carol.
One moment, please, let me get my notes up.
Sure.
Okay. So I have a couple of updates in reference to parking. And the first facility is at New Carrollton Station, which is affected by the New Carrollton East Side Joint Development Project. And the park and ride lot, which is a surface lot in front on the east side of the station, is going to be permanently closed on November 23rd. And the ADA parking spaces will be moved to the park and ride lot, the parking garage lot on levels 2A and 3A. The reason we're moving those is because we always advocate for trying to keep our parking spaces. And in this particular case, we aren't able to keep all of them accessible parking spaces as we move. But they will be gained back when they rebuild a new parking structure at that location. However, we're moving 12. 10 are going to be regular ADA parking spaces on the third floor of the parking garage. And two of them are going to be van accessible parking spaces that are going to be reserved accessible parking spaces as advocated by this committee, where a person who needs accessible parking spaces with an access aisle can reserve spaces similar to those that do not have access aisles in that facility. And they will have special signage saying that you can't park here unless you reserve from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. And in order to do that, of course, you pay the additional fee.
This is at the Fairfax stations?
No, this is at New Carrollton Station. And the reason what we had said is we're going to try to incorporate these as we are renovating or doing something with that facility. So in this particular case, although we hadn't talked about this station, we found the opportunity to do this since they're going to be moving this parking spaces. Okay. And we are going to be doing the same in the Vienna parking garage, which is in Virginia. And They have a non-WMATA related project of renovating a street overpass on over 66. And because of that, they're gonna close that street overpass and the entrances to the Vienna parking garages on both the north and the south garage are gonna be closed on that side. And the ADA spaces will not be affected. Other vehicular entrances will be available. And we are gonna coordinate with the Office of Park to try to include the two reserved accessible, van accessible spaces in that station as well. And we're gonna continue to do this, and we're hoping to have a target by the end of November to get them on the recently renovated stations on the Orange Line. And parking was not part of that renovation, so we're adding it at the tail end, okay? And so that was my report in reference to parking.
Any questions?
I see Doris, you have your hand up, so go ahead, please.
Yeah, I guess I'm confused, and I go through, I think you're talking about Vienna Station, and I go through Vienna Station all the time. So are you saying that one side of Vienna Station, including the garages, are going to be out of service starting November 23?
Actually, not at all. No, no.
It's
just the parking structures. As you know, the Vienna parking structures are huge. They're one on the north side and one on the south side.
Exactly.
And one of the entrances to those parking structures is going to be affected at each one of those lots. Garages. And it's basically going to affect the way you enter and exit that garage if you happen to use that exit.
So it's only going to be a garage thing.
Yeah, it's a garage thing. And what I said is, we're also going to try to get the reserved accessible parking spaces in that garage during that time. But that was separate, but it was relevant to this committee, so that's why I mentioned it.
And it's going to be north side or south side to begin with, and then will you do the other side as well? Or
I believe they're closing both of them at the same time because it's a particular road that's being renovated and that goes perpendicular to the station, to the rail and the station.
Any other questions? If not,
yes, this is Darnice. I do have a question.
Yes.
Uh-huh. My question is, which stations have available restrooms for the public? And will those restrooms include hand sanitizer stands? And what's the procedure to use those restrooms?
Okay. Currently, the restrooms are closed to the public.
Except Silver Line. There are public restrooms at Silver Line.
Yeah, they're WMATA has closed all the public restrooms during
except
the pandemic.
Except the Silver Line.
I could check on that. There was no exception in my knowledge.
Yes,
to my knowledge.
But that's a pandemic thing? That's a pandemic
yes.
thing?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I get it.
Okay. Any other questions of Carol? If not, we can move to the committee discussion of the effect of COVID-19 on the budget. Now, some of you have been able to testify this morning, and maybe, Phil, you could mention your experience. And Steve, did you get a chance to testify too? Hello?
Don't Dr. Posner?
Yeah, I'm just unmuting.
Sure. Hey, Phil, I'll speak too.
Yeah, actually, Patrick and
Paul.
Both testified, as did a couple of the people that testified to our committee about the Pentagon bus route.
Yes.
The Washington bus route. And basically, there wasn't a lot to testify about because what they're doing isn't going to take place until January. And what they're actually going to do is going to depend upon what happens in Congress. And so what they have done is prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And basically what they have done is help put out a bunch of things they could do that could cover 16% more than what they really need. So the people that come in and talk to them about what they really need, they can occupy the 16%. And they'll make that decision when the time comes. The major people that are being impacted right now are the bus users because they're saving their money, one, with layoffs, two, with negotiations with the union, and three, with reduction in service on the bus and on the rail. And because most of the folks that are still working now are using the buses. And so we took a positive approach in our testimony and suggested things that they might do for those people, such as implementing the microbus pilot that they're using in Montgomery County in all of the other areas. If you remember, Heidi came and talked to us about the B2R program in DC, bus to rail, and we had the people that were running that come talk to us. And we suggested that that was so successful that they might consider having Virginia, DC, and Maryland institute a bus to rail program. Then the third thing that we suggested to them during the Orange, Blue, and Silver Line shutdowns, they develop working relationships with the federal government and with several of the large employers that were affected by that. And the private organizations set up parallel transit for their workers to get them to and from work. And that was really critical, particularly for the overnight workers, since the rail was going to shut down at 9 o'clock. So those are the positive suggestions we made. We also thank them for maintaining our Metro Access service through the 1st of July and hope that they would continue that after the 1st of July because it was really important. And then Patrick also said, requested that they keep Abilities Ride as a potential option to save them money since it's less expensive to use Abilities Ride than Metro Access. The problem being the contract requires they spend money on Metro Access and they'd be paying for unused facilities on Metro Access. So that again is, think about it and let the professionals do the calculation and deal with it. And I know Chris does that constantly. So we trusted them. And that was pretty much what we talked about. And as I say, most of the people spoke were people that were impacted by cuts in their bus service that was there. We also brought up the issue about the inaccessibility of the website and that we were inviting the people that control the website to come to our meeting and talk to some professionals that understand what the regulations are and how people can actually follow what's on the website. So I think that was it. Patrick, do you want to add anything I missed?
Yeah, the only other couple of other things, and thank you for I basically echoed Phil's testimony. I did talk about the usability of the website. The maps that we looked at earlier, Phil, someone with low vision, there was no good color contrast. These are things that the professionals should know how to do. So actually you, me, and Paul said exactly the same thing on the websites. I also thank them for the for some of the work they're doing at the rail stations during the downtimes, you know, that we've had with the rail, particularly in the area of lighting and those projects that are important to us, that they've kept those going which we're all aware of. So, we had a kind of a mixture of microtransit stuff, bus deserts, and you know, that sort of thing. And so there were about, I think there were 20 people that gave testimony, and then there was another 20 that they had videotaped. So you basically had 40. And as Phil said, the bus to the Pentagon, I think that's the 8Z, there were about six or eight people that all said the same thing. So it'll be interesting to see if that bus, they got an earful on that bus route. And Glover Park also was mentioned too. So we'll see.
Steve, did you also testify?
What's that?
No, I thought Steve might have testified as well.
If he testified, it wasn't a bit, we didn't hear any, I didn't hear any video testimony from him. Could be written testimony. They didn't read that.
Yeah, what they did was they had the people that testified live, and then they had recordings of the people that had telephoned in, and they had recorded the telephone calling. And then also the people that had made videos and sent them to them, they played those. So
they played the videos, yeah.
Yeah,
You didn't get your video and live testimony, Phil, though.
Well, the funny thing was, I had taped mine and sent it to them, and my email won't transmit anything that's that large.
Oh.
And so I recorded mine and put it in something called the box, which is a storage area that compresses it, and then they can take it out of the box. And then I got an email just before the meeting started saying, gee, we're sorry, we don't know how to use that technology. Would you mind doing it live? And so I told them to talk to Anu, because Anu knows how to use the box because she's the one that taught me about it. So anyway, I had to wing it and do it live, but it was good because I had cut my recording down to about 2 minutes, and I got an extra minute by doing it live.
So the hearing is over now?
Yes, but you can still submit written comments through the 19th. And I will also, you'll see my letter to the board. My letter to the board will cover all the things that we said, and any more that you guys would like me to add. And then I will do another recording with Anu, who knows how to use the box, and give it to them again. So we have a lot of input to the board. We really do. And the three board members that were there were the executive committee. So Stephanie Goldman and Smedberg were all there for the hearing and interacted with us.
For those who are going to submit written comments, you have until October 19th. I hope you'll do so. One thing, Phil and Patrick, did you say that, what about buses? Though things are being cut back or limited, are at least buses being prioritized?
Well, that's why they're having the hearings. They have put out a list of the buses that they're going to reduce service on. And that's based upon what ridership has been during the hours and what it costs them to run it. And they're just doing a financial analysis. And that's why it was so important for people to come in and explain to them why it was more important. There were several groups in DC that were retired military, that were living in senior citizens' homes, that was their only transportation. There was a group in Alexandria that is in a true transportation and service desert. There's nothing there. And if they take their two routes away, they can't get anywhere to get food, entertainment, doctors, dentists, whatever. And so that's why it was so critical for these folks to get in there and to testify. And so the final decision is going to be made on financial basis plus impact on different communities. Mm-hmm. And so basically the big folks that showed up were from senior citizens communities, minority communities, and retirement communities. And there were three of them that basically either had one representative of 60 people, or in one case, they didn't register correctly. So they had 10 people there, but only three of them got to talk. But they made the point that is critical. And that's something that the board and the GM is going to have to make the decision of, you know, who gets hurt.
Yeah, and I think, Phil, a good, I think what was proposed, the bus microtransit and the public-private partnerships, both of which they've done, so they know how that works, and why they can't implement that to help out these neighborhoods that need the service, rather than just throw it in their lap and say, we don't want this. At least we were able to give them somewhat of a solution that they could try to implement.
Yeah, I think about the Pentagon group that, you know, was a really large group. I'm sure the Pentagon can work out a shuttle. One would hope that they could. And for a number of the retirement communities, they were retired military or teachers or whatever, that the retirement military groups are very active, and I'm sure they can put together something that would give them shuttles or...
Did anybody speak up for Ward 7 and 8?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. They did.
Okay, very good.
And also you had people speaking up for Prince George's County, too.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And that came up several times. So
excellent.
Always an area of concern for us.
You know, hi, this is Steve. I was wondering that, you know, a lot of the cities have these little, different cities call them different things. They're these little dash buses. You know, they're about half the size. The seats are arranged on the sides. And, you know, they have actually, you know, doors, of course, in the front and also on the side. But they're about, about half the size of the regular Metro buses. And they must cost a lot less to run. And, I noticed that some of the routes just don't have the ridership back, the bus routes. And these might be a very efficient way to provide service, you know, at least during this period. And I was wondering whether some cities that have these have them sitting off to the side, you know, because they serve a lot of the downtown areas, and that's where people are no longer working. They're actually working from home. Whether WMATA might even lease these on a year or multi-year basis.
Yeah, this is the microbus concept where they would either run a fixed route through an underserved community that will take them to a hub so they can get out into the world, or you can actually make a phone call and they will come get you and take you to a hub where you can catch one of the buses that's running on a regular schedule. And that's in their bus transformation project as a major suggestion. And as I say, Montgomery County has been doing some pilots in that area. So you're absolutely right, Steve. And particularly in small areas like Arlington and Georgetown, where the big buses just can't get around.
Right. Because Doris has, on a number of occasions, talked about service areas which really aren't populated, but nevertheless are isolated, except for, you know, buses of bus, some kind of service. These might seem to be ideal.
In terms of the pandemic, though, if they're so small, how can you deal with social distancing?
Well, they're not that small. And the number of people in those areas that would be calling for them would be between 1 and 5 per vehicle. And if they're wearing masks and there's good ventilation, I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, it can be done.
That's great. Okay.
Okay. This is Anu. I just want to make sure that we stay on time for the meeting.
Yes.
I just want to read Anthony Oberg's comments for the record, and then I see Doris Ray and Barbara, they both have their hand up. So after I finish reading Anthony's comments, Doris, go ahead and make your comment quickly, and then Barbara. For the record, Anthony states advocacy will be different than it has been in past years. As we have heard, without some kind of federal assistance, the entire region will face shortfalls. This may mean less contributions to Metro. It has always been important to advocate that for adequate transit funding, but it feels especially important now as we deal with the uncertainty of when we will return to normal, and he has normal in quotes. It may be tempting for people to look at the low ridership and think, why should we fund this at the levels we were? We need to remind those people that some of us use the system regardless of the times. We will need to balance the financial dilemma of the pandemic with the future of the region. Doris, go ahead and make your comment, please.
Doris?
Oh, okay. I wanted to number one, say to the committee that I had planned to testify, and I called today. And I called the 962-2511 number. I called today, but I called before that. Once they answered and told me that this was only the line to call if you wanted sign language interpreters. And another couple times I called trying to get a telephone number to call in on, because I wouldn't be calling in on Zoom, you know, visually, because I don't have the camera set up, given my adaptive screen and everything. So I never got a call back from them. And I called today, and I never got a call back from them. So that, together with the fact that there was such short notice of these meetings, I think the AAC needs to bring that up. I will also say that I sent out an alert in Northern Virginia about the hearings and the testimony, because I knew it wasn't going to reach people in time. So I gave them information about the written testimony, but I did have some problems with the website, so I'm glad you're going to bring that up to them, because it was a big issue. But the last thing I want to say is, I know in Fairfax County, the problem is that some of the long line bus lines that can get people from one part of the county to another, since the beginning of the pandemic, they set those bus lines back to service only on Sunday service schedules, and you know, 7 days a week, and brought them back up to a certain degree, but it's not at the level where it's useful for anybody. And I think we need to make the point that using demand statistics right now, you know, ridership statistics, is ridiculous, because it doesn't really accurately and appropriately reflect the demand that might be out there if they, you know, if they didn't continue to reduce service and, you know, operating hours plus frequency, and then on top of that eliminate some routes or sections of some routes. And I say that from the Virginia perspective, although I looked at the entire docket of the bus service changes on bus routes, and I feel really bad for parts of the district and for my compatriots over there in Maryland, where I used to live. So I think the other thing is that the
Doris, you have six more days to provide.
I just want to say one last thing. The other thing is that that the whatever they're called, what you just called it, the sub bus system. I think for the long line rides that some of us need to take, even just to get to work here in Northern Virginia, it's not really feasible. And if regular commuters aren't going to transfer three buses to get where they're going on a usual basis, they're not going to do it now.
If you could include these things in your written comments, you have 6 days. But I would also...
Oh, I'm going to do that. But
I would also suggest that you mention the problem you had in trying to get on as in your written comment. I think that'd be very helpful. Is there anyone else who has a comment? If not, we have to go into the front door boarding.
Chair Columbia, Barbara has had her hand up. So Barbara, go ahead and make your comment quickly.
Thank you.
Sure.
I live in Fairfax County, and I agree with what Doris says. It seems like we have been kind of left out on things. A lot of the bus routes that aren't traveled very frequently have been discontinued due to COVID. And that does really nothing to help the people who live there and chose to live there because they thought they were going to be on a bus route. Fairfax County is, of course, just as important as Montgomery County and the D.C., but it seems like, you know, those other jurisdictions are getting a little better bus service due to the ridership, and I'm going to include that in my comments to the board, but I just want to remind you folks of Fairfax County, and trust me, we are not all rich. We cannot all take the star because we don't live in Arlington County. So we really do depend on the bus service. Thank you.
Barbara and Doris, when you do your written testimony, could you carbon copy the Access Advisory Committee, Accessibility Advisory Committee as well? I hope you would.
Tino, could I, while we're still on this, could I very briefly just say something?
Yes.
Thanks. I was deficient in not signing up. I missed the Thursday cutoff that Chris had set up, and I thought I could easily get on after 6 o'clock and didn't realize that I couldn't. So I'll be submitting my comments. In fact, I had practiced what I was going to say to make sure it was 3 minutes, but it'll get there by the 19th. In any case, you know, one thing that I've been concerned about is wondering if there is a senior level review of major expenditures, even after they make it into the budget, at the time the outlays or at the time the commitment is finally going to be made. And I particularly bothered by the screens, the readers, which we currently have in many of the bus stops, which are only two lines. This is about the only bus system I've seen which has two lines. And they're very easily readable. But the moment you have narrative relating to COVID-19 or narrative relating to bus issues or what have you, one can stand there for up to 90 seconds, reading this information before the actual next bus information appears. And I just wonder, you know, another thing was, if you remember the communication about how much it costs before you board a bus, which rattles through the bus, and it's still on the buses, even though we're not charging anything anymore. I just wonder whether a senior level review, almost at the presidential level, maybe a senior level department, might have asked the right questions to determine whether we were actually buying the things which we should have been buying. Thank you. Okay.
Steve, may I make a comment? This is Carol Lopez.
Oh, sure, sure.
And in reference to your comment about the bus, the reason that the bus screens have such large fonts and go as slow as they do have to do with code requirements for people with disabilities. The ANCA and the International Building Code NC A117.1 standards dictate how slow changes in text can occur in those types of low resolution signage. Okay, so you can't have too much change, otherwise somebody who has low vision is not going to be able to capture it as they're reading it. So, and the reason that the font is so large is because the ADA requires you to have a certain font size if it's above 70 inches above the finished floor. So if you have a sign that is higher than 70 inches above the finished floor, you have to have at least a 2-inch font size. The reason other places have signage with smaller lettering is because they're not paying attention to those standards. And in WMATA, we are very careful about those things.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Carol. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Just keeping in mind that it is 5:26 and we still have several topics to cover. Chair Calabia, we can move forward to the next discussion for front door boarding.
Yes. Any comments on front door boarding?
Anthony Oberg, Vice Chair of PRS, has submitted his comments. I can start off by reading his comments. And in the meantime, if anybody has any comments, please go ahead and raise your hand. Anthony says, in keeping with my comment, and that this is, I'm just reading as he wrote, on the budget, I think there must be consideration for front door boarding to recoup some of the lost revenue for the system. It should only be implemented if it can be done safely or at least with the same risk anyone takes when taking transit these days. This means masks should always be worn by our drivers. Encouraging riders to wear masks as well and doing our best to adhere to social distancing. If Metro went this route, it should closely monitor the situation. I do not imagine we would see a large change in ridership over this. People who are riding will be riding, while people who have not been riding will continue to avoid Metro. And that concludes Anthony's comments. Dr. Posner, I see your hand up.
Just to add to that, that's the commentary that we have given them. And I quoted a member of their executive committee, Mr. Goldman, who was talking about eliminating the turn back on the red line at Grosvenor, and said the amount of money you would be saving compared to the amount of hardship you would be imparting is not worth the cost. And we use that quote to describe front door boarding, that the danger you would inflict on the driver and the other passengers as people walk by everybody to get to the back of the bus versus the amount of money you might actually collect would not be worth the risk. In addition to that, you might collect less money, can't collect less than zero, but the ridership might go down, because there are some people that might see this as a major risk. And so that was in both mine and Patrick's presentation, and we'll go into the board report yet again. But I think that's one of the ones that they're less likely to implement.
And Phil, the only other thing that I would say is there was some very good testimony based on, you know, you're taking the easy route of furloughing people, letting bus drivers go at a point when you absolutely need to have the service. So you could think, and they don't have time to do it now, about taxing the within X amount of quarter of X amount of within the subway system, all these restaurants and other things that are making money because they have a great location, and taxing them more and helping them pay for the system. But that is more to do with planning and less to do with, you know, reactions. And so I don't know if they'll take some of that to heart, but there's probably a better way to pay for what we need to pay for rather than reducing service and letting bus drivers and other people go and furloughing people.
Any other comments? If not, we can go to Dave. David, for the ombudsman report. David, I think you have to unmute.
Okay, thanks. The only thing I have is to respond to Steve's questions about the 42 bus line. Jim Hamry advised us that this was this split between the 42 and I think it's the 43 was made last year when we had the bus service changes, and they haven't changed it since then. So you should be seeing what was already approved in the previous hearings last fall. I can email you the link for the schedule if you want. I don't think we've changed anything there.
May I comment?
Sure.
Okay. On August 23rd, it changed significantly. That's right. It's interesting. I attended a DuPont Circle, tenants committee meeting, which and the bus was brought up by a number of people. What changed is not that there is now a 43 and there wasn't a 43 before. It's just that until about 6 or 7 weeks ago, the 43 was just running Monday through Friday express periods, morning and afternoon rush hour, and the 42 was running all the time. By making the 42 and 43 split service, one was a positive change. The 43 does not start all the way in town, but rather starts at Farragut Square, and that's fine because service all the way down is not needed. However, the 43 bypasses the three DuPont Circle stops because it takes the tunnel. So, Jim Hamry, it's right, there was a 43 before, but what happened is there are four or five people always waiting for a bus now in two of the DuPont Circle bus stops for quite a bit of time, up to 30 minutes. And the main reason is the change in the use of the 43. Now, I just have one more sentence. I believe this change was made based upon a survey or based upon information which was valid before the pandemic, and at this point is no longer really valid. Express service into downtown is just not needed anymore. But Jim is right in what he said. I think that decision was made in, shall we say, a different world.
Yeah, well, we're going to have another different world in January if we don't get a COVID relief bill.
Oh yeah.
So I think for the next couple of months, it makes sense to let's see what happens in January.
All right, Dave. Thanks for checking.
Yeah, that'd be a good time to address it with Jim. If we are able to return to normal service, then we can talk about it. If we're not, then it's a different question.
All right. The ombudsman report item has been covered.
Chair Calabria?
Yes.
This is Anu. Yes. I believe Ms. Lopez has some information about the lighting in stations.
Okay, go.
Right. Mr. Sheehan asked to provide a report that deals with percentage of lighting upgrades. And I did a little homework. We did a little homework, our whole group. And Well, we are able to report that 100% of all underground stations have received new platform lights where the edge of the vault and internal lighting has been replaced. 100% of all exterior stations have received new LED light bulbs where incandescent or fluorescent bulbs had been used. And this provides brighter and even lighting throughout the outdoor stations. Outdoor stations are receiving new, more efficient light fixtures during each platform rehabilitation project. So in the outdoor stations, we're doing two different levels of changes. One is we've changed all the light bulbs and everything's brighter, the light bulbs are cleaner, and it's brighter on our outdoor stations. But the second level is going to be when we actually replace the fixtures and the light bulbs and make them more energy efficient, et cetera, and brighter, maybe improve certain areas that didn't have enough lighting on the platforms. And there's another effort where in some stations, relamping of downlights has been placed as a new task order. And these are the stations where we have the downlights and it's still dark. So those stations are, for example, Roslyn Station has just received new downlights at the mezzanine level. I guess in Roslyn, mezzanine is next to the platform. But Anu, do you have that? Yes, there you are.
Can you see?
It's up.
Yes.
It's
okay,
up.
So you could see them being busy taking tile out and putting new lights. Can you go to the next one as well, Anu? Okay, and in this one, they're replacing the downlights, as I was talking, so that there would be even lighting in the platforms as well from those downlights. Because prior to that, they had done the vault lighting, but now they're replacing the downlights. So I'm hoping that Roslyn Station is going to meet all your scrutiny, and we're going to be okay with that station. And there are other stations where we have to look at, and what we're trying to do is provide a list to the architecture office to create a priority of which stations they should address. And we have listed Friendship Heights, Metro Center, Lowell Platform, we're also going to go and look at the Pentagon Station lighting issue that Doris had talked about. I think that may be resolved, but we haven't been able to go and check it just yet. And if there are any stations that the committee finds that need to be looked at in addition to those, we'd be glad to put them on the list.
I'm glad you mentioned Friendship Heights, because Paul Kelly brought that to our attention maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago. If you could eventually put up pictures like you had of the other stations when the workers deal with the Friendship Heights problem, that'd be very helpful. Any other comments? Barbara, do you have a comment? Doris?
Yes.
On lights?
Yes, I do. I would like to commend you folks on that. Roslyn has always been so dark. And those photos that you were showing with the lower ceiling, if you will, on the lower level of Roslyn Station, that is excellent, excellent. I really, really appreciate that. So do other people. As you may know, Pentagon is a twin of that. It looks very similar, and they're having the same issues there. Last time I was there on the lower level. So I'm sure that if you're doing the right things in Roslyn, you're also going to be doing the right things over there that it's twin stations. So again, keep up the good work. I also wanted to know, I couldn't really see, you're flipping through those pictures pretty fast, at least for me, but are you going to be hitting the wall lighting there too, or have you?
That has already been completed.
Okay, because the lighting's lighting going up, shining up, just adjacent, couple of feet from the tracks, that yes. was always just very weak, and the bulbs were on, but it just wasn't managing to get up to where the light was needed, so you couldn't see the signs that said Roslyn, for example.
Okay, yeah, that has been completed according to our architecture department.
Can you send me those photos?
Sure, I can send them to you.
Okay, thank you.
Doris?
Yes, I'll be interested to see, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be interested in seeing Roslyn and Pentagon, but I haven't recently. You mentioned something about the outdoor station lighting, the first thing that came to my mind was something like West Falls Church, particularly because it's an outdoor station, but the lights are needed both on the lower level and on the mezzanine levels. I know that we've had some problems with initially when Barbara and CCLV did the survey with the lights there. The biggest thing I wanted to ask you is, if you're going to be working on that, and other outdoor stations, you know, their mezzanines and such, how are you going to go about looking at the situation both from the daytime, because when it's cloudy, I think you need light in there, and I think you do turn on those lights, but and then at nighttime, it's a wholly different story. And particularly places like West Falls Church, where you're really underneath the mezzanine level, at night it can get plenty dark. So I'm wondering if those are the kinds of things that
the West Falls Church has been rehabbed this summer. So there should be substantial improvements over there. I can't answer the daylight question. I do know that there's some emergency lights that are always on, but I don't know if they're related to the darkness of the station. I guess you are talking about something at the mezzanine level. But we have standards that they have to comply with, and I should hope that they have done that, but I will follow up on that.
Particularly the but I'm talking also about the platform level where you're actually underneath the mezzanine for portions of that platform level at West Falls Church and other stations that are of similar nature. The other place that I recall is very disconcerting was going out to Prince George's Plaza Station when we were going out there to see the Metro Access call center. And during the day on bright sunny days, with the ceiling over you, you know, where you're about to enter the station and go down the escalators, boy, is that dark, and you don't really benefit from the natural light for at least people with vision impairments. A similar dark place in Virginia is Eisenhower Station, where you're on the platform.
Carol respond.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to challenge the sun with artificial lights. I mean, when you're in a space that has both a shade and a shadow, or in shade and outside, your eye has to transition. And sometimes your eyes don't transition as fast as others. and it's very understandable, but I don't know how we can actually combat, you know, to duel the sunlight with artificial light. And you're saying that this happens when it's cloudy, or is it when it's sunny?
Doris?
But actually there are three dynamics. The dynamics are sunny days, cloudy days, which are often better, and then nighttime. And I've seen some of those effects even at the newest stations, like the Tysons Corner stations. So maybe more talk about that is warranted, or more input from us.
Okay.
So we have one last question from Phil Posner. Dr. Posner, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you for Rosalyn. It looks really bright and nice. The only question I have is, have they repainted the wall?
Because
it wasn't just the light, it was the actual wall was so covered in soot, dirt, and everything else that you couldn't read what was written on the wall.
Dr. Posner, I think that had to do with the signage as well. Yeah. I need to check that. I don't know. If the signage is dirty, then we can't see it. Yeah.
Yeah, the lighting looked great, but the signage itself looks like it needs to be replaced.
Carol,
and then I can retire.
Carol, this is David Schaefer. I had Plant check into that, and they told me they cleaned those signs and those walls at the lower level of Roslyn. Thanks to the last time I heard this comment.
Yeah, but David, I've looked at them after they said they cleaned them and you couldn't read them. So I don't know what their idea of cleaning is, or whether they're really clean, but the lettering is just so light and, you know, gone that you can't see it even when it's clean.
All right, well, I could check with Plant again to verify that.
Yes, please do that, David, and tell us at the next meeting.
Okay.
The Union Station is the best example about what paint can do.
Yeah.
Well, there's going to be a lot of work at Union Station. In any event, it's already 5:48, and were there any public comments?
Tino, this is Carol still. Did you want me to give an update on the detectable warning tile? That was something that Mr. Sheehan asked for information.
Yes, please, if you can do it quickly. We've only got a few minutes.
Okay, so Mr. Sheehan wanted information on when these stations received detectable warning tile. And I have a really quick one. The last set of detectable warning tiles were installed in 2015. And the reason that Arlington Cemetery was missing is because there was supposed to be a project that was completed by 2014 on that station, a rehab project, and that got pushed to 2015, and then it got pushed again. But now we have it as a priority, and it's scheduled to be rehabilitated starting February 2021. So we should receive detectable warning tile along with the entire platform being rehabbed for that station.
Could you?
That will be the final one, huh?
Yes.
Good. Thank you.
Could you record that in a CC to all members, what you've just said, so we can keep track of these things?
Sure.
Well, it's going to be in the minutes as well, Chair Calabia.
Well, I'd like to hear specifically what she has to say as soon as possible. In any event, we just have 10 minutes, or are there any public comments? If not, I have a couple.
Philippa has one.
Okay.
Yes, go, Philippa.
Okay, mine is quick. A few weeks ago, I was at L'Enfant Plaza, and I went down to catch the blue orange line, and I couldn't remember if my stop was on blue or on orange, and the station ahead signage was off of the pylon or whatever they call that column that's up, and I walked the whole platform and couldn't find a station ahead sign. So I was wondering, has that been rectified or will it be rectified? And I know they can't give me an answer right now, but I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, if we could take that down, and maybe David and Carol can look at that and get back to us. Any other public comments?
I have received none through email or voice messages.
Go. Quickly.
I have not received any.
Oh, okay. One of the things that came up, and I sent you all an email, and it also included, I think, a video clip made by one of the passengers. You'll remember that last week there was an uncoupling of Metro Rail trains near North Capitol Street. And I must admit, it took them over an hour to, first of all, maybe even to inform the passengers as to what happened, but certainly to get them off the train. With respect to the video, it was lucky that it was during daylight and outside of the station. I can't imagine what would happen if people were having to be rescued or helped out underneath. At the same time, I looked at the video a couple of times, and I wondered what would happen if someone in a wheelchair or some other person with a disability had been caught in that situation. Even though it was sunlight, it must have been hard for them to walk along that shale along the tracks, which calls to mind again the business of the I don't know, it may have even preceded my being on the committee, but Denise reminds us about the necessity for a waiver, and it was brought up recently. Staff has told us why WMATA feels that it can't do it, but maybe we should take a tip from Judy Hoyman, the advocate, and try and figure out how we can not only urge WMATA to work out a waiver, but get them to actually do something. If they can't provide a waiver for members of the advisory committee, in particular for those who use walkers or crutches or wheelchairs to be present when the rescuers are training, I fear for, you know, another uncoupling or whatever happens in the next emergency underground, you know. So let's put our minds to figure out how we can take a tip from Judy Hoyman, the advocate who's will be interviewed tomorrow when you watch it. The other thing is that attached to the email I sent you all regarding the discoupling of the train near Union Station, I also attached my note to the Director of Communications of Hitachi. As you know, Hitachi has been selected to build the 8000 series. And just as Glenn Millis has discussed three times with this committee, the various ideas that this committee has about improving the vehicles used by Access, we should also get with it with Mr. Nahomi and possibly even with the Hitachi designers to talk about the kinds of ideas we've had regarding how to accommodate people with disabilities on the 8,000 series. In any event, those are the two public comments that I make for the record. And are there any other comments that members or people who are on phones have?
We only have 5 minutes, and I see Dr. Posner's hand up, and I think I just heard someone, I'm not sure who.
Darnese.
Okay. We only have 5 minutes, so I would request everyone to take, please, maximum 1 minute. Dr. Posner, go ahead, please.
Under a minute, in response to Tino's suggestion of being proactive, when I brought up the waiver issue in my physical report to the board last month, I suggested one of the answers would be to self-insure for that issue. Many large companies do self-insure a number of issues because the cost of the premiums are too high, and the amount of claims that they would have brought to them from the disability community for replacing wheelchairs, injuries to dogs, brief visits would be so small that it would be a small amount for them to self-insure. So we are being proactive in that area.
Thank you.
In short, each of us would have to self-insure.
No. WMATA would self-insure and eliminate the waiver.
Oh, excellent.
They would
let's make sure that gets done. Yes, Christian and Carol, could you make sure that gets done? Because I fear the next time there's a Metro Rail accident, the people who are supposed to rescue us won't have experience in managing wheelchairs and other passengers with disabilities. Is there some other, I know, did you mention somebody?
Darnese.
Yes, it's Darnese. And I just wanted to make a comment about, as I was watching the tape of the people unloading from the accident.
Yes.
It reminded me of the times that we really did work with WMATA and, volunteer to be victims. I shouldn't say victims, but volunteered to...
play victims.
Yeah. The thing about it, I looked especially because I didn't see anybody that had a disability, a major disability, get us. And I heard that they had actually stayed on there an hour, which is ridiculous. Then, yes. People had to slide on the floor of the train and then have somebody help lift them off. And if anybody had been in a wheelchair, they would have had to leave their wheelchair. And people with disabilities are always taken off last. So I think maybe we should ask to come up with some kind of guidelines.
Yes, well,
for people with disabilities to unload.
Well, maybe the next time we can have people from our committee go on and then report on the experiences that we feel need to be corrected by the rescuers or WMATA staff. We're close to, it is now 5:58. Any last words of wisdom?
Before we move on, Chair Kalabi, I just want to say that due to time constraint, we will not be able to discuss the new old business and work plan updates. And I also want to share that anybody willing, would like to send us their public comments can do so via email at metroaacchair@wmata.com. That's all one word, metroaacchair@wmata.com. And you can call and leave a message at 202-962-1100. We are very prompt in returning phone calls and addressing any issues. If any of the committee members or any members of the public who are present in this meeting at this time would like to make any further comments, please feel free to email them to me. You do have my email address, and we will get your concerns or comments shared. I believe Mr. Blake was trying to make some comments, but seems like he's having some connection issues. Besides this, we are at almost 6 o'clock.
It is six o'clock now.
So we're out of time.
So we're adjourning the meeting. Thank you very much. And we'll see you at next Monday's meeting. Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Tino. Excellent meeting, Tino. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hi.
Thanks a lot, Anu.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you.